Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White show. Each week, we feature different topics concerning issues that sometimes can be difficult to talk about. These issues concern children and adults who may be autistic, have Asperger's, or have mental disorders of any kind. We will discuss law enforcement and how they interact with these persons. Now, let's start the show. Good evening, and welcome to the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White show. My name is Jenny White, and I'm thanking you for spending your Friday evening with me. Tonight is the last Friday that we will be talking about African American inventions, but we will be talking about African Americans all through the shows in 2018, 19, and however long this show lasts. But we try to, in February, to kind of specifically spotlight some of those African Americans that have done fabulous things back in the past, and some of those that are doing fabulous things now, because we're always, always doing fabulous things. And for that, I am so grateful. So thank you guys for listening. Tonight, we will be talking about Charles Drew, and I'm sure everybody is familiar with who he is. And Charles Drew was someone who, in the late 1940s, before the U.S. entered World War II, and just after earning his doctorate, Drew was recruited by John Scudder to help set up and administer an early prototype program for blood storage and preservation. He was to collect, test, and transport large quantities of blood plasma for distribution in the United Kingdom. Drew went to New York City as the medical director of the United States Blood for Britain project. The Blood for Britain project was a project to aid British soldiers and civilians by giving U.S. blood to the United Kingdom. Drew started what would later be known as blood mobiles, which were trucks containing refrigerators of stored blood. This allowed for greater mobility in terms of transportation, as well as prospective donations. Drew created a central location for the blood collection process, where donors could go to give blood. He made sure all blood plasma was tested before it was shipped out. He ensured that only skilled personnel handled blood plasma to avoid the possibility of contamination. The Blood for Britain program operated successfully for 5 months, with total collections of almost 15,000 people donating blood, and with over 5,500 vials of blood plasma. As a result, the Blood Transfusion Betterment Association applauded Drew for his work. Out of his work came the American Red Cross Blood Bank, and this was in the late 1940s. Beginning in 1939, despite a popular myth once repeated on an episode of the hit TV series MASH, Drew's death was not the result of his having been refused a blood transfusion because of his skin color. And I will repeat a popular myth to the contrary. Once repeated on an episode of the hit TV series MASH, Drew's death was not the result of his having been refused a blood transfusion because of his skin color. The myth spread very quickly, since during his time it was very common for blacks to be refused treatment because there weren't enough Negro beds available or the nearest hospital only service whites. In truth, according to one of the passengers in Drew's car, John Ford, Drew's injuries were so severe that virtually nothing could have been done to save him. Ford added that a blood transfusion might have actually killed Drew sooner. He had a car accident, and he was driving around 8 a.m. on April the 1st, still fatigued from spending the night before in the operating theater. He lost control of the vehicle. After careening into a field, the car somersaulted three times. The three other physicians suffered minor injuries. Drew was trapped with serious wounds. His foot had become wedged beneath the brake pedal. When reached by emergency technicians, he was in shock and barely alive due to severe injuries. And it is said that his injuries were so severe that virtually nothing could have been done to save him. And Ford added that a blood transfusion might have actually killed him sooner. So, well, I don't know. I only can vouch for the invention that he did that started the blood mobile. Whether or not he could have been saved by a blood transfusion is something that we will never know. So on that note, I will take a break.
This broadcast of the PJC Media Network seeks to present wholesome, thought-provoking, and entertaining content. However, the views expressed by the hosts of PJC Media are theirs and theirs alone. They do not reflect the views of this network or its affiliates. Please utilize listener discretion.
Autism affects 1 in 68 children, sweeping all racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic groups. Autism is a lifelong brain disorder that leads to untold challenges to the physical, financial, and social well-being of people with autism and their families. Resources are stretched thin. The Autism Alliance of Michigan, a collective voice for families across the entire state, uses resources to help families battle challenges right here, right now. If you or anyone you know needs help navigating the autism journey, contact the Autism Alliance of Michigan today, 877-463-AAOM, or visit them online at aaomi.org.
We're back with Let's Talk About It with Jenny White. Okay, and we're back and we're talking about inventions of African Americans then and now. And I see we have a question or a comment. Hello, caller.
Hello, Jenny White. How are you?
I'm well. How you doing?
Great. Wonderful. Wonderful. Figured I'd join you today.
Okay. I appreciate that. You going to hang around for a minute?
Hang around for a minute.
Okay. Great.
Want to introduce me so people know who they're talking to? Listening to?
Oh, okay, people. You're listening to my fabulous son, Maceo. Maceo Coleman III, Trey. So we're going to hang out together this evening. Thank you so much, son. And
we're still talking about
black inventions back then and some now. As a matter of fact, right now I'm going to mention we're going to celebrate Sophia Dannenberg, who is the first black mountain climber to reach the top of Mount Everest. She is a Harvard grad and a Fulbright fellow who started mountain climbing in 1999. She scaled mountains around the world before her epic two-month climb of Mount Everest in 2006. She pitched her own tent. She carried her own gear. She battled bronchitis, frostbite, and a storm. But she made it. Yay, Sophia. Thank you. If you want to climb Mount Everest, you go right ahead. And that just lets you know we can do anything we put our minds to do. So you have to find your goal and what you're supposed to do and do it no matter what the obstacles that come your way. So that's really good. And if any of you listeners would like to make a comment or ask a question, you may press the 1 and you will be streaming live. Another person who made history is Miss Sarah Boone. If you've ever tried to iron a shirt, you can appreciate how difficult it is to iron the sleeves. Dressmaker Sarah Boone tackled this problem and invented an improvement to the ironing board in 1892 that would make it easier to press sleeves without introducing unwanted creases. She was one of the first black women to receive a patent in the United States. At age 15, she married freedman James Boone in New Bern, North Carolina, as a dressmaker while he was a brick mason. They had 8 children, and she lived in New Haven for the rest of her life. She filed her patent in July 23, 1891, listing New Haven, Connecticut as her home. Her patent was published 9 months later. There is no record found of whether her invention was produced and marketed. Boone's patent was not the first for an ironing board, despite what you may see in some listings of inventors and inventions. Folding iron board patents appeared in the 1860s. Ironing was done with irons heated on the stove or fire using a table that was covered with a thick cloth. Often women would simply use the kitchen table or prop a board on 2 chairs. Ironing could usually be done in the kitchen where the irons could be heated on the stove. Electric irons were patented in 1880 but didn't catch on until after the turn of the century. Sarah Boone patented an improvement to the ironing board on April 26, 1892. Her ironing board was designed to be effective in ironing the sleeves and the bodies of ladies' garments. Boone's board was very narrow and curved, the size and fit of a sleeve common in ladies' garments of that period. It was reversible, making it easy to iron both sides of a sleeve. She noted that the board could also be produced flat rather than curved, which might be better for the cut of the sleeves of men's coats. She noted that her ironing board would also be well suited for ironing curved waist seams. Her invention would be most convenient to have for pressing sleeves even today. The typical folding iron board for home use has a tapered end that can be useful for pressing neckties, necklines of some items, but sleeves and pant legs are always tricky. Simply iron them flat with a crease. If you don't want a crease, you have to avoid ironing over the folded edge. Finding storage for a home ironing board can be a challenge when you live in a small space. Compact ironing boards are one solution that is easier to put into a cupboard. Boone's ironing board may look like an option you prefer if you iron lots of shirts and pants and don't like creases. So a lot of people, maybe they didn't invent something, but they did something to make it better. So that's also good too. We need those. So we're going to take a break, but if you would like to make a comment or ask a question, just press the 1. Be right back.
We'll be right back after these messages.
This is Jacqueline Jones Frederick of Jones & Frederick Enterprises, Inc. This incorporation consists of a tutoring business, a tutoring staffing, and a traveling business. We have serviced the community since 2007. Our clients are third graders to college students. We tutor in all academic subjects. Please call Jacqueline at 586-306-5487.
This is Carla Cook, daughter of the legendary Mr. Soul Sam Cook. You're listening to Dovetails with Deborah Lapidus.
No, you're not. No, you're not. Okay, we're back with the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White show. We have another person who is not old and who is working on it. We're celebrating a mathematician. How about that? Somebody who likes numbers, who helped develop GPS technology. Her name is Gladys West. She graduated from Virginia Tech University on a full academic scholarship, where she received her master's degree. She is the second Black woman to join the Dolvin, Virginia Naval Base, where she spent 2 years developing the GPS technology that today is used by everyone everywhere, from NASA and the military to your phone, your car, and your social media. I bet you guys didn't know that Miss Gladys West help develop GPS technology, even though it took her 42 years to do it. But still, how many of you out there use GPS technology?
I know I use it. I'm trying to remember what I did without it.
I know.
I was having a conversation the other day. We had a map, so we'd have to use the maps to get to our destination.
Right.
No, I ain't talking about MapQuest. I'm talking about the paper maps.
Oh, you're talking about paper. Okay.
I'm talking about before GPS.
I remember I was riding with a female named Terry one time, and we were in a U-Haul truck. Yes. And she was attempting to read a map while driving. And that to me was, well, I guess it's similar to texting while driving. But way back then, texting was not even invented. But that's something. I remember MapQuest. That's what I used to use. The MapQuest.
Oh, I'm talking about before MapQuest. You were using the phone before MapQuest.
I didn't know how to read a map.
Oh, really?
I mean, you know, it's kind of difficult.
It took a level of, you had to study it and figure it out.
Yeah, well, I didn't have that much patience. So I learned to use MapQuest, which was, pretty popular during the day. As a matter of fact, I still used it before I finally changed over to GPS. But it does use a lot of battery if you're using your phone.
Yeah.
But, it's a handy thing, and I understand what you say when you're trying to figure out what you did without it. I see we have another caller. Hey, caller, how you doing?
And how are you, Jenny White?
I'm fine. Thank you, ma'am.
And I enjoy your program. Well,
thank you.
And this is my favorite time of year because I love, besides Christmas and Easter, I love to talk about Black history.
I know, especially you.
I love it. I really love it. It was said a long time ago about the late Malcolm X that he would sit up nights talking to his friends about how he wanted to help his people out, Black people out. And he would come up with a plan to do this and do that. You know, he came up with the Organization of African Unity. In other words, the African-American here tying hands with the African countries over there. I was reading someplace now. I was looking at a program on I think it was PBS, about Haiti. You know, Haiti's been really under a lot of pressure since Hurricane Katrina. And
right.
A lot of countries promised to send them, give them money and things like that. But so far, a lot of them haven't come forward. Someone has said that one of the problems with Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton was that Hillary was supposed to make sure that the money reached Haiti, and it never came. I think one of the college students mentioned that. And so here this program was talking about a lot of the people are living in camps and things like that, and they're wondering when they're going to get the money. They're trying to use the machinery they have to rebuild, especially in Port-au-Prince and all of this. But I read something just a couple of days ago, how that Haiti is now tying hands with this Organization of African Unity, reaching out to other Black countries in order to get help. You know, and it seems like now we're coming together as a black people coming together, trying to help one another, to build each other up, instead of looking toward the main establishment for help now. I thought that was interesting as to what's been happening.
You said Katrina, right? Because I think
Wasn't it Katrina that hit them, and then they had that earthquake? They had an earthquake.
Oh, Haiti?
Yeah, Haiti. Didn't Katrina hit Haiti also?
Just
from the United States, was it? I know they did have the earthquake. I should say the earthquake. Yeah, the earthquake.
Yeah, it was earthquake, right.
Okay.
And they're still
okay.
Suffering from it. Most of the people are living in tent cities and things like that. And, you know, that's nothing but a breeding ground for disease and so many other things, you know. And they've been waiting through the United Nations. The last time before they had this election, the president or the premier or the prime minister went to the United Nations saying the things that they thought they were going to get in order to help the country out, but it hadn't come forward yet. And they were talking about what the former President Obama had promised, and it never reached them and things like that. And it was a big meeting they had when Hillary Clinton and her husband Bill Clinton were sitting, former President Bill Clinton was sitting there, and he was saying, well, things are forthcoming, but in other words, they just hadn't reached them in all this time. And when was that earthquake? I forget when the earthquake hit them. But they were saying, we need help. We need the help. We need this. And then they were talking about a lot of corruption and things like that. But now you see them tying hands with other Black nations to see if we can pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps instead of waiting on the establishment to help us out. And I thought that was interesting.
But you know, that's unfortunate. That's really unfortunate because I think Katrina was the hurricane that it was said that all of that money that the Red Cross received was not given to those people. And you know, that
They're talking about corruption.
I don't know if it's necessary. I'm not going to say it's corruption. I understand that workers have to be paid. I just don't know why it is that the people could not receive money. But look at Puerto Rico now.
It is.
They
look at them, yeah.
Recently got lights, got electricity in some spots.
Yeah.
So, you know, those hurricanes and things are not a joke. And what do you do when the money doesn't come? What do you do?
Yeah, it's unfortunate a lot of times when you're dealing with you know, millions and millions of dollars. And, you know, when you have these catastrophic events that, you know, the corruption and greed comes into play.
Yeah, it does.
With awarding contracts to friends or newly formed businesses that receive $30, $50 million that's never performed a job before. And, you know, it's you know, sometimes it's not what you know, it's who you know.
That is true. And they made all these promises, but very few people are coming forward with those promises to help. They send some workers to talk, and they sit around the table and talk your problem and talk it and talk it. It reminds me of what the Little Red Sox said. He said, you go down to those people, talking about the welfare office, and you're hungry, and they come to your house and look under your bed. instead of, you know, we know how that goes, you know.
I heard they were looking in your closets, too.
Yes, they were. Claudine hiding the television and things like that, yeah. Yeah, all of this. But one of the things I know that the late Malcolm X, he wanted us to tie hands more with Africa, the Organization of African Unity, and the UN, and the United Nations, to accuse the United States of the same inhumane treatment of the African American peer. And that was when he, you know, they began, and a lot of the African countries did do that, to say, hey, what are you doing here? You're saying that we're doing this over here and over here, but look at what you're doing in the United States to the African-American person who are supposed to be free. They're supposed to have their citizenship the same as anyone else, equal rights and things, and this is not so. And I remember that became a big issue with them. I was thinking, you know, I like to hear about what we're doing, but I have noticed I was at the gas station recently, and I, you know, I was thinking about the governor election. Aren't we supposed to have the governor election this year?
Yes, yes.
And so I asked this one.
Sheree, Sanadar, Tent, what?
Yeah, but I asked a friend, I said, have you heard of any black person running for governor trying to take over that position or anything like that? That person said no. And when I was at the gas station, this person in front of me, I asked the lady, I said, have you heard of any black people running for governor? She said, no, I haven't. You know, she was in the lottery line. She said, no, I haven't heard of anything like that. To me, because of what we've gone through as people together, the election, we come to find out that the last election, come to find out all this corruption that hit our election, we were trying to elect, you know, cast our votes, come to find that we had so much Russian interference and all of this, and there's been so much. I think that we have come to the point we're just disgusted with the whole system. Why be bothered, you know? It was a time when Detroit would carry the state of Michigan, but they've cut up your district your vote doesn't matter. And then the problem with the machines and things like that, if you look at our history, we voted, we have fought for equal rights, the civil rights issues. The civil rights program exists because we put it together. But we're the main people who have not really benefited from it at all. Not really.
Yeah, and then they're trying to repeal a lot of, you know, the civil rights and affirmative action legislation that has been put in place.
Reverse discrimination and all this other stuff. So where do you go, you know? Now they're saying... as far as the party is controlling the presidential office, the most powerful office supposedly in the world, but you can't go there. You know, people have gone to talk with him there, but there's no help there. There doesn't seem like to be any help at all. Then you look at the Congress, what are they doing? And then when you look at the Supreme Court, it's almost like it's back during the time of slavery, really, if you look at it. There's no, where can you go to bring your case to make it heard? You know, you just don't have it anymore. And I do believe that we, as a people, have become very disgusted. And the whole system, where can you go? A lot of people are dependent upon the mothers who have lost children who were shot and killed by the police They were looking forward to taking their cases before the Supreme Court. But, you know, what are you going to get there?
Not justice.
Beg your pardon?
Not
justice. It is. They were looking for justice and abuse. Where can you go to get some help? Where can you take your problem to, your complaint? Excuse me.
If you're talking about a politician.
And to me, we are discouraged people. Go ahead.
If you're talking about a politician, I don't think there are any. But you know what? I take that back. There are some real nice politicians. I mean, they're good. When I think of good, I mean people like John McCain. Now, when Obama was running against him and the lady said, well, I don't trust him because I think he's a Muslim. John McCain came and said, no, ma'am. He is not Muslim. I thought that was fantastic for him to do. That was his opponent. And he did not let anyone smear this man's name.
Also, you talk about what John McCain did. Look at what he did as far as the Affordable Care. Since he's going through all of his changes, he said, hey, them people need their medical because he know what he needs. Let's face it.
Hospital, up from his sick bed, and voted it down. Yes. But you know what? Unfortunately, he's ill, and I hate that.
But yeah.
I appreciate your comments, and I have another caller. And
okay, then.
Call back. If you were you done? I mean, if you had another comment you wanted to make, well, we're here.
I'll call back.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Okay, thanks so much. And I do.
You're welcome. Caller, did you want to ask a question or you had a comment?
Yes, ma'am. A little bit of both. Thank you for taking my call, first of all. And
no problem.
So
can
far.
You give us your name and tell us where you're from?
Yes, ma'am. My name's David. I'm calling from Arizona.
Okay,
I just wanted
David.
To say, thank you. I've been listening to a lot of Malcolm X speeches recently and just sort of trying to get an understanding of his philosophy. And a lot of things that he was saying in the mid-1960s was really relevant to what's going on with the black community now. And he often talked about how the people then became political chumps because they were throwing their support at that time 80% behind the Democrats and were basically the difference maker in every election at that time and were getting absolutely nothing for it, even though the Democrats at that time were like controlling 2/3 of the Senate and 2/3 of the House and had the presidency, and they were doing nothing. And I feel like we're committing the same mistakes again and again repeatedly, where we're throwing all our support behind the Democrats, whether it be a white Democrat or black Democrat, doesn't matter. And we're just getting pulled along here, and at the end of the day, we get nothing for it. It just seems really
frustrating. So what do you suggest we do?
I thought Malcolm brought up some great points when he talked about black nationalism, in the sense that he said, instead of looking to the government for help, what we need to do is economic infrastructure within our own community. By that, investing our money within ourselves, trying to develop our own businesses and stores, and control our own money in our own communities, and not constantly let outsiders in, and also with that, not going to the government for handouts and constantly getting involved in government programs. Because the minute you do that, there's a whole bunch of strings that are attached. That's why all these programs you see in the black community, they always have some little string that goes along with it that the government put in there, and it always leads to our people becoming weaker, not stronger.
Okay, so do you have a solution?
Yeah, the first solution I would say is in the next election that black people as a whole just completely boycott the election altogether to make the Democrats value their vote. Because right now the Democrats take the vote for granted completely. And without the black vote, the Democrats cannot win a single thing in any national election. And they know that. And until we as a people make them value our vote the way they value the Hispanic vote, because you notice how they go after that vote, because the Hispanics are like a 60-40 split between Democrat and Republican. And so that's one way if you want to actually become politically strong. Otherwise, if we keep doing what we're doing, just like Malcolm said, we become political chumps. We just become a pawn for the Democrats that they show up during the elections, but the rest of the time they could care less.
Yeah, I agree with you as far as the Democrats definitely taking the black vote for granted. I don't know that the answer is to not vote in the election. I think that that would probably serve us a bigger disservice, you know, in that instance, because as it is with the gerrymandering and redistricting of the precincts around the country, the Republicans have been able to gain a foothold with a number of different seats in, you know, their elections just based on the fact of even in Democratic majority Democratic areas, just based on the fact that they have been able to redistrict and gerrymander the voting line, and you know, make it even harder for blacks and minorities to vote based on voter ID and you know, different things where you know, it discourages a lot of people from voting, and at this point it's worked for them. But as far as the solution goes, I don't know if, you know, creating a totally independent party, you know, would be the answer to, you know.
Well, we already have that.
Well, I mean, there is an independent party, but it's, you know.
Well,
not
no, I never said an independent party. I said as far as the black national thing has to do with as far as how we deal with our own community, how we spend our dollars, how we, you know, try to start our own businesses and not let Asians and foreigners come into our communities and open up shops in our community and take our money. That's a separate issue. Politically, you can still vote Democrat, Republican, either one doesn't matter. The point of the matter is that make your vote actually valuable and make the Democrats work for your vote. They don't work for the black vote at all. And I'll ask you this. You brought up gerrymandering and all the, and the way the Republicans do things. Can you tell me any piece of legislation that significantly separates the Democrats and the Republicans right now?
I think the some legislation that would support Medicare and Medicaid and, you know, different, as they say, set-asides that would benefit blacks. But a lot of things that benefit us benefit, you know, the whites and majority whites. You know, even as far as the food stamps and things of that nature, there are more white people on food stamps than it is black. So in regards to any legislation that would particularly favor African-Americans, I can't think of any offhand.
Well, my question to you, David. Okay, were you done, Mae? Because
yeah,
I need to ask David, how would you propose that we get African Americans to agree to do that?
Well, I mean, that's the part of the challenge, and that's the challenge that Malcolm.
Yeah, you got that right.
In the mid-60s, and he at least made enough of an impact. I felt like because he had the voice and the ability. Get the attention of the people. But at this day, compared to the 1960s and now, black people become weaker. They become more dependent on the government. You have so many black leaders that are basically funded directly from the government. And so because of that, basically our people have become to the point now where it's like government funding is all they go for. Like there's not even an attempt to become independent in any way, shape, or form. They're happy to take a handout. And if you go back to the 1950s and 60s, it used to be a shameful thing for anyone, let alone a black person, to get any handout from the government at all. Now in today's society, people aren't even ashamed to get food stamps or handouts. In fact, they're out there demanding it and wanting more of it. And so instead of working to try to become financially independent and empowering our own, you know, community economically, rather our leaders are running after government money. And so they're willing to weaken us in order to get more government assistance and keep us in a state of dependency forever. And so it's counterproductive to what we're trying to accomplish But because we have this backwards thinking in our community, we're stuck. We can't move.
Well, you know, I agree with part of that. I think that there's a, you know, percentage of people that depend on government subsidies, you know, and welfare. I don't think it's the majority. I think, you know, the majority of people.
It is the majority.
Oh, I don't believe that. You know, I believe
Yeah, let me break it down for you. Out of the 38 million black people that are in this country, African Americans, 26 million out of the 38 million receive some form of government assistance, whether it be food stamps, you know, housing, or some type of government aid in some way, shape, or form, whether it's health care or something of that nature. 26 million out of 38 million. Now, if you go back to 1955 and 1965, the percentage was far lower than it is now. It's much higher because our leaders, instead of focusing on economic empowerment for our own people, both on the personal and on a collective level, instead they've been chasing after government money. They've been chasing after more welfare, more food stamps, more government aid, more government. And what does that do? That once you start to become dependent, it grows. Dependency grows because people naturally prefer the path of least resistance. It's much harder to become economically independent. That requires hard work, discipline, sacrifice. So people naturally want to take the easy route. And that's what our leaders have done because our leaders have lied to us. And because they want to be supported by the Democrat Party, that's where we're at now. And so unless you get to the point where our people say, we're done getting government assistance, we're done getting government handouts, unless it's in an emergency situation and we want to force ourselves to become economically independent, it will never change. These Negroes are running after that government money and do whatever the government tells them, as long as they keep getting that government money.
I tell you what, you know, these corporations are getting government money and government subsidies and tax breaks and all that, so I'm not necessarily against black people receiving government money. You know, I'm against black people, you know, receiving government money to be held down as far as welfare and to become poor. But if I think you can get a hand out that can assist you in becoming better and making a better life for yourself, I don't think anything's wrong with that. But if you just want to take, you know, oh no, I'm not kidding you at all. I mean, you know, that's why.
Okay, so what about
people
that live in government housing their whole lives?
Well, that's a problem.
That's okay.
No, that's
a lot. And there's a lot of people in our community that have been living in government housing for decades that aren't even trying to move out and get their own place. They're not even going to try. Why? Because
that's generational. That's generational, and that's a slave mentality, and that's a poverty mentality, and that's a problem.
That's our problem.
But, I mean,
and that's our number one problem right now. We become
but everybody
weak,
doesn't,
and we want to stay weak. That's our number one problem.
Well,
I don't think we necessarily want to stay weak. It's just that sometimes we get in positions and we don't see a way out, and we can't.
Let me sometimes
get into positions and we can't see our way out. I'm not
saying there is
no way. I didn't say there was no way out. I said that we can't see our way out.
Well, let me say this, because, you know, white America has had a 400-year head start on us. And so, you know, they've established the rules, the regulations, and for the most part, they've been made to keep black people down. You know, as far as employment, you know, if legislation wasn't put in place, you know, in jobs, you know, and in receiving a percentage of contracts, and in having a percentage of minority students in colleges, you know, I think the numbers would be even worse than they are right now. So I think that, you know, certain things, you know, we didn't receive reparations when we, you know, when slavery was over, you know, and so a lot of people had to start from scratch. And so, I, you know, like I said, I don't think that there's a problem with saying, you know, 15% of government contracts to build, you know, the stadium in an urban area has to go towards minority participation. Because if you didn't put that in place, all the white people would get the contracts, and black people
Because even now the Hispanics get a lot of the contracts. Why? Because they do a better job than a lot of the white companies. I work in a lot of construction contracting, you know, business, both down here in Arizona, California, and in Texas. And if you know how many Hispanic businesses get chosen over white businesses, it's astronomical. Why? Because they work harder, they do a better quality job for a lesser price. And at the end of the day,
right,
anyone who's in business is in business to get highest quality for lowest cost. So in business, they don't care about your skin color, they care about what you produce. What affirmative action has done, it's had two effects. First effect, you're correct. It's enabled some of our people to be employed, even though if you look at the numbers, the employment rates really haven't changed previous to affirmative action and afterwards. The second effect that it has is that it's made us less competitive. And that's part of the weakening part of process, what I'm talking about. I'll give you an example.
You say less competitive?
No, it makes us less competitive, and I'll show you why. If, for example, let's say you want to, if you started a workout, let's say you wanted to build muscle. The number one key in building muscle is not by doing less weight, it's by getting more weight. And why you do more weight? Because you add more resistance, which then causes your body to naturally adjust to the added resistance to become stronger to be able to deal with it. That's an effect you see both in your physical, and that's an effect you see in the mental. And so the more adversity, the more resistance there is in a situation, it mentally makes a person have to adjust and become stronger and become more competitive and adjust to the changing climate. When you make the climate easier and less resistant, naturally the mind itself adjusts to the less resistance. That's why our people, you see our people who stay on government assistance for their entire lives and never try to get off of it. Because once you give into that easier mode, it's very difficult to break out of it. That's a fundamental nature of human beings.
Well, that's
why
our people, you know, and it's, you know, and like I said, it's generational. So, you know, I can agree with you on that point. But, you know, I think black people are one of the strongest people, you know, on earth regarding, you know, what we've had to endure throughout the years, not only from the continent of Africa, but across the world and even here in America. I mean, you know, you can look because you can look at the number of suicides. You know, and I've been reading the paper lately where, you know, families, fathers have been killing wives and children. Just read a story, you know, here in Michigan where a mother, you know, I think she was in her 40s, husband was an engineer at University of Michigan, two college graduates, children in their 20s. You know, the mother was depressed. She killed the husband, the two kids, and herself. You know, there's another story here in Michigan where a mother killed
that doesn't,
two her
that doesn't
kids.
Make white people stronger than white people. White people are stronger based fundamentally, number one, because they control the world. They are the main power economically and militarily in both Europe and America. So you can get into the whole, you know, personal
weaker.
Thing about people, this and that. Now, that's what
makes
it weaker. That makes it weaker
based on your argument, based on the fact
no.
that white
yeah, yes, yes.
Okay,
fellas.
In that regard, now,
yes. I need to take a break now, and you guys take a breath, and we're coming back.
All right, hang
if
on.
If you are in need of life insurance, auto or home insurance, or need help in getting out of debt, call your helpful insurance agents at Prime Financial Services. Did you know? If you add a child rider to your life insurance policy, you can add multiple children for the price of one, starting at $10,000 worth of coverage for under $10. Call today for a free quote at 313-293-0979. Mention you heard this ad on this show for a free gift.
My name is Sheila White. I am the president and co-founder of Her Cries Are Heard, an organization that focuses on preventing violence against females. One in three women have been victims of physical abuse or violence by an intimate partner or non-partner within their lifetime. 94% of women killed by men were murdered by someone they knew. Violence can affect a woman's physical and mental health and also negatively affect her children. In 1991, my sister was murdered by her husband. And in 2013, my niece was murdered by a man who followed her home from a party. Being a victim of violence is devastating to the victim and the victim's family. Help us to help you. Help us to prevent this from happening to you or someone you love. Please look at our website, www.hercriesareheard.org, for the prevention tools and referrals to help save lives.
We'll be right back after these messages.
This is Jacqueline Jones Frederick of Jones & Frederick Enterprises, Inc. This incorporation consists of a tutoring business, a tutoring staffing, and a traveling business. We have served the community since 2007. Our clients are third graders to college students. We tutor in all academic subjects. Please call Jacqueline at 586-306-5487.
We're back with Let's Talk About It with Jenny White.
Okay, we're back. And I thank you for hanging out with the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White show this evening. We're talking about African Americans and how we can get ahead in this man's world. David, I want you to hang on for a second. I have another caller that I need to get in right now, and I'll come back to you. Caller, you're online with Jenny White.
Hello, Jenny White. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm good. This is a very good show. I'm glad to be on again tonight.
Well, we're glad to have you tonight.
I was just listening to the previous caller, and I wanted to say hello to the guest. Guest, how are you?
Hello.
You're the guest.
Well, the guest that was on before me, I wanted to say hello.
You're talking about David from Arizona.
Well, yes, both of them.
He's a caller. He's a caller.
All right, okay. Maj, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you, brother?
Wonderful, brother. Good to hear from.
I was not planning on chiming in. I just wanted to kind of listen, but after listening to David, my finger just had to push the button. I think it's very, very important and critical that we choose not to listen to the rhetoric and to the narrative that people want us to believe. I hear David saying a lot of things, but I don't know how many of these things are based on what he is seeing as one person in this huge world, or is this thing, are these things that are based in facts? Because the facts are clear. Per capita, there are way more white folks than there are black folks on welfare. I heard a comedian say today, if there were only black folks on welfare, there would be no welfare, because this government is not in the business of trying to help out black folks. The reason
why we do
have welfare is that there are black folks, but there are also white folks. There are more white folks on welfare than black people. Now, if all you see is what they want to show you, inner cities, which is people killing each other, which is people on welfare and not trying to get out, then that's what you're going to believe. But that's not the story. Affirmative action, there's no way affirmative action makes us weaker because of there's less resistance. And I do understand his muscle, lifting muscle analogy, but there's a couple of things that are missing in that. You have to realize that, again, this society, our American society, was not set up for us at all. Just like the previous caller said, a 400-year head start, they still have a head start. We're still not on equal ground. I mean, there are people who, just like there's ageism and sexism, there are people who still look at names. If you have an Afrocentric name, there are people who look at names on resumes and don't hire those people. There are people who don't hire business people because they don't feel like a black person can portray a certain image. This stuff still happens, and the proof is actually what's happening now. These white supremacists didn't just spring up over the last 365 days. They were always here. They were just lying dormant until their opportune time to strike. And now, since we have an idiot in the White House, they feel like this is their chance after 8 years of people saying, wow, my president is black, and now we have an idiot in the White House. They feel like this is their time to strike. This stuff is not new. None of this stuff is new. There's nothing new under the sun. All of this stuff is repetitive. It's going to be like this for a while, and that's why I don't believe that there are so many successful businesses that are headed by black people who've never been on welfare. I think we need to realize that and not just look at what's outside of our house, but we need to look at what's based in facts and what the true narrative is instead of what people want you to believe. I'll wait for you.
Yeah, I agree with that, you know, and you also have to look at the dynamics that, you know, there are a lot of single-parent households in the black community as well. And I think, you know, with that, you know, but that's by design as well. I mean, you know, single-parent households aren't just because, you know, a lot of these dads on their feet decided to leave. You know, the system has been set up, you know, to create a pipeline to prison, which is a privatized business,
that's
to get a
true.
Lot of these black men off the
that's
street,
true.
You know,
that's
and getting them
true.
Off the street and out of these homes, you know, has created a void for male presence in the black community. And so, therefore, there are a number of families that are on assistance because, you know, it's hard to work and provide daycare for your children, you know, for children that are, you know, under school age because daycare is expensive. So, you know, that's where Head Start comes in and things of that nature. So, yeah, we, you know, it's not a problem. I don't have a problem with people receiving government assistance to get ahead. You know, I've got a problem with people receiving, you know, trying to beat the system or, you know, relying on the government as a lifestyle, you know,
right.
But you know,
but that's not a black issue, though. That's not a black
no,
issue.
No, it's not a black
thing.
That's true.
If you go down in rural Tennessee, there are Caucasian people who are doing the exact same thing as black folks. But, again, who controls the media and who gets their story out? They want you to believe that that's a black
that's
issue. It's only black people who are on welfare. It's only black people who want these handouts. It's just not
right.
true, and it's not. But it's not that, and we need to be
and I don't think,
well aware. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I don't think you got to go all the way down to Tennessee to find that.
Right. So what you're saying surmises that it's fake news?
Well, all of this is fake news, but again, we have to always try to remember who controls the news, who controls the story, who gets out. Whoever gets their story out, that's what people believe. I mean,
that's
the whole thing about Trump will have you believing that Barack Obama is a Muslim, and the fact that so many Americans, instead of just researching and just something simple in this day and age, researching, but because Trump said it on the news, and since he put it out, and since Trump has unlimited finances and he can just say what he wants to say on the air, people started to believe that. And that's why we have the narrative that we have in America about black people on the south side, west side of Chicago, shooting each other up and killing each other. You can't walk down the street without getting shot and all of these. That's what – now, is there a problem? Absolutely, there's a problem. But it's greatly blown up because that's what they want you to believe. It's their story, and that's what they
that's
need
true.
To push out.
That's true. And, you know,
okay, thank you. And let me get David back into this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
David, are you still here?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Did you have another comment that you wanted to make?
Yeah, I could just sum it up quickly. First and foremost, basically all you basically did was you just tried to say because this other group of people are doing this wrong, this somehow justifies when blacks do it. That was not my point at all. My point is to deal with the issues that we have in-house, not look at what other people do and try to justify our negative actions by doing what they do. So that's an irrelevant point to the discussion. second point, when you guys brought up the key point when you talked about the single mother rate, you go back to the 1950s and 60s till now, the single mother rate went from something around 20% in our community to now it's around 70%. And you said it right on the point when you said the system created that. What system? The welfare system, because it incentivizes mothers to have children and not have to get married, because the system does not give money to mothers if there's a man in the house. So what did that do? That created a system where you had women, more women becoming single mothers, less men in the household, which then led to young men growing up without a father figure, which then led into the criminal lifestyle we've seen being perpetuated everywhere. And even with that, they use the prison industrial complex as a way of saying that all these black men in jail are in jail for innocent reasons is a total lie.
No, I didn't say that.
The way you said it, you're implying that these people are nothing more than victims. Some of them may be. The vast majority of them are in there because they made bad decisions. And you can make the argument that their bad decisions were influenced by their parents' bad decisions, which negatively affected their life.
Let me ask you this. If you've got an ounce of powder cocaine and an ounce of rock cocaine, why is the sentencing guidelines different? I mean, it's the same ounce.
That's easy. That's very easy. You go back and study it. Who are the ones advocating for stricter laws against rock cocaine? People within the black community that did that because the crime rates we were witnessing in the 80s and 90s. So during the 90s, when Clinton came to power, black people were advocating for stricter laws against that to try to get drug dealers out of the community. Go do your research on that. That's where the whole three-strike law came, and that's why Bill Clinton became tougher on drug laws against drug dealers, in particular with crack cocaine. Because there were leaders in the black community that was pushing for that. That wasn't a white person generated thing.
Well, no.
Well, I have a question.
Yes, it is. You go. You look it up yourself.
That's not true.
I have a question, guys. Why is there a school-to-prison pipeline then? What are they doing not educating our black children? That's what they're not doing.
And that's exactly what Malcolm X talked about. Malcolm X said that when he talked about the fact that we're dependent upon the government to educate our children. We're dependent upon the government to do this, to do that, and this, that, and the other. And
okay,
when you
David,
do that, when
David,
you when you allow
David,
your enemy...
David,
okay.
There are guidelines that you have to follow when you are in the school system. You have to teach these children this, this, and that. That's what you have to teach them. Now they have taken cursive writing out of the schools. Half of the children in the schools cannot read. So therefore, when they're being pushed along because of their ages, they leave the school system and they end up making those bad choices and they end up in the prisons that other people have built and are making money from.
Well,
There's a system in place for a black male to leave a school system and go to prison.
What percentage that has to do with the parents? Because, my parents taught me, I grew up in a really bad neighborhood where we had a high crime rate in the 90s. We had a massive gang, culture influx from Chicago. And that, my parents made sure to teach us right from wrong, took a hell of us accountable with our schoolwork, made sure we did stuff on our own with our parents to teach us how to read and write and all of that. So part of it, you got to also hold parents accountable.
I'm just saying parents have
much greater an effect than the education system is secondary to what the parents do for their children. Your parents, I'm sure, taught you morals, taught you to be responsible, taught you how to handle things, taught you how to react to certain situations.
My parents took me to church, and that
proves my point. They had more of an impact on your life and the decisions you made in your life than what you learned in school. That's secondary. So when you talk about people. So that's my point. That means we got to take more responsibility for people who do things that are fundamentally wrong. Like you didn't see this crime rate in the 50s, in the 40s, in the 60s in our community. But we didn't have this percentage of people killing our own people or engaging in all this criminal behavior.
We were segregated at the time, and so we depended on.
It's because the black community had more character, and we were more accountable, and we didn't put up with the nonsense that we put up with now.
We,
you,
we, uh,
you,
Well, a lot of that.
No, because you're justifying it. You just justified it. You talked about.
I know I did.
That's my point. So you're the type of person that would defend a criminal, and try to victimize a criminal. I'm not going to victimize a criminal. I'm not going to defend a criminal.
No, not.
That's the difference between you and me.
Why then do we have all these killings by police of unarmed black people, and they'll take a mass murderer and take them alive, but they're all white?
Compare that to the number of black people killed by other blacks, and you're telling me that that's even remotely close? That's not a drop in the bucket.
That's not my point. You're not.
That is my point.
You're bringing
up something that is infrequent compared. If you want to talk about the real
issue, I wouldn't say infrequent.
I'm saying infrequent relative to gang violence.
I have another caller to bring online, fellas. Hold on. Caller, you're online.
Do you have a comment?
Yes.
For me?
Yes. Do you have a comment?
I was listening to the conversation, and I thought of this idea that I remember the late Malcolm X was trying to bring in there was this. You remember the black city that was bombed in Oklahoma years ago?
Oh, Tulsa.
Those black people. Beg your pardon.
Those people had a community.
They had a community where they had their own Wall Street.
Yes, they did.
They had their own Wall Street, their homes. They had their own businesses. They functioned as a unit together. Their houses had running water and bathrooms and things like that. A lot of the white homes and other cities did not have, and they functioned within themselves. We can do that.
Look what happened.
Yes. Okay. What happened was, here we go again. A white woman accused a young man of saying something, winking at her, something crazy. And the black man went to talk to the establishment, about it. That led to an argument, a fight, and they ended up bombing that city. I think recently the United States had to go back and pay what happened to it. But even in this country, if we are, like you say, controlling our own destiny, having our own, they're going to find some way to get in there to mess it up. We had to do a reconstruction, just to bring out the point. It has to be something more than us getting up, than us becoming self-sufficient. They were a self-sufficient community. They were functioning among themselves. They didn't have to go to the powers that be. But they were bombed. They bombed that entire city. They found a reason, to bomb it. Look at what happened with Roseville.
That's just one story. I mean, there have been massacres for years and all over the country, and as I do more research, I found, there was a massacre in Slocum in 1910. There was another massacre in Wilmington. There was another one in Carolina where they burned the only black-owned newspaper.
I remember. I think I heard about it. The woman was newspaper woman. I think I heard about that one.
Yeah, so there, if you look up black massacres in the United States, you'd be surprised the number of incidents that will come up that you probably never heard of. And so it just goes to show, when black people make progress, how there's been...
Without them, yeah.
They will find something.
Yeah.
They've outnumbered the black people. They have more artillery. and guns, and that's one of the reasons the NRA is losing their mind every time, you know, an incident comes up where they, you know, threaten to change gun laws. They lose their mind because white people don't want guns taken out of their hands because they feel that they'll be at a disadvantage. You know, the minority population, or brown and black population, is soon to be the majority in America, and that's going to be the Hispanics, which is, I think, you know, probably at 17% now, and African Americans at 13%, and I think in the year 2045 or something, they're looking to have where black and brown people will be the majority in the country, and white people are scared to death of it. So that's
so
why
you think,
you know,
that might have something to do with number 45 building a wall?
Tell me about it.
There's a wall already there, but yeah, that's just that's not going to stop him. You know, that's just flaming the rhetoric for his base. You know, and letting them know, you know, those are all cold words. You know, if they give him $20 billion to build a wall, half of that's probably going to be misappropriated, you know, and the wall is never going to be built. You know, they need to reinforce border control.
Even so, they'll find another way. People said they're flying in. They're not climbing a wall to get here.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They're getting visas and they just not leaving, you know.
Yeah.
So, so either to go to school or go to work. But, you know, they just sent, I think they're in the process of, they just denied 50,000 Haitians low wage work permits so that they no longer can get jobs here in the U.S. So, you know, it's definitely
not
black
that's
and
not
white.
Surprising.
You know,
that is
it's
not surprising.
It's not even black and white. Black people, we have our issues, but, you know, a lot of our issues are created by white people, too. We've got our own issues, but, you know, there are a lot of issues to keep us from being equal. So.
I was looking at a program recently. I know we're over, but it was called A Slavery by Another Name. It was on PBS. And they showed even through the 13th Amendment, they sure, we were said we were supposed to be free and equal and all that, but they had the clause in there where through the they could treat you like a slave if you made a felony. And they talked about the peonage law where a white person can come and say, well, hey, man, you owe me some money. The man said, I don't owe you any money. But through the laws and through that, you could go to jail. Then they could take you and use you as a laborer in cotton, anything that they wanted to. And it was hard for you to do it. A lot of children, they were saying about 90% of the chain gangs and things like that. This is how they were got the cheap labor that they needed. Slavery by another name. Peonage law. They were fined anything to say you were vagrant. It was going to be through the legal system, and this is what people are screaming about now. It's the legal system that they're getting, privatizing the jails and things like that to keep you in a subservient position. And it was an interesting program.
That's exactly what happened, you know, once the, amendment was signed to free the slaves in 1865, you know, they just, like you said, found another way to get free labor. If they could imprison you and, you know, for violations of whatever, you know, manufactured sort. It wasn't that you committed a crime, you know, necessarily.
Working in the coal mines and things like that.
Yeah.
They're literally stealing their lives away from them. Finding some way to keep you in that position. I learned through Tom Joyner, I didn't know that, but my cousin, doing her research, family research, she found out, and my father never mentioned it, but it's a case in Florida where his brother was lynched, pulled out of jail and lynched. And his brother was a businessman.
Mm.
And he would talk about it. And so I asked my mother, she said, well, yeah, your daddy told me a long time ago. It was in 1946 that his brother was killed pulled out of jail and killed. And he was a person that had a crop and all of this other stuff. And it's a case that they talk about even in Florida, even now. You know, and she was saying she was listening to it. And then finally she found out that that was actually related to my father, you know. He never told us about it. He never told us, but something like this, it happened, you know. Some way to keep you in this subservient, less than a full citizenship, you know, servitude.
I mean,
I just thought I wanted to put that up.
Yeah, well,
I appreciate your comment.
Okay, and thanks so much. And thank you, David and the other caller. It is something we have to consider. Even if we do good, evil is present.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
That's biblical.
Thank you
okay.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. I have to go to one more break, and we'll be back.
Want to start a business or have tax issues? We know exactly how to handle your individual needs. We personalize each individual and give you the time required to focus on your needs. We audit you before the IRS does. The IRS is not on your side, but we are. We set up companies, do tax preparation, tax and retirement planning, bookkeeping, IRS audits, and reviews. Please call me, Deborah Mitchell, owner of Mitchell & Company, for a free consultation at 248-354-5122. And visit my website, MitchellTaxAccounting.com.
This is Terry from Texas, and I love listening to the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White show.
We're back with Let's Talk About It with Jenny White. Okay, and we're back. We're talking about black people in America on the Jenny White Show. I have three more black inventions that I want to tell you about. When you drop a letter in a public mailbox, you expect it to reach its destination safely and in good condition. Before 1891, people using the U.S. mail couldn't make those kinds of assumptions. Public mailboxes were semi-open, which made it easy for thieves to steal mail and for elements like rain and snow to damage the letters. Philip B. Downing changed that with a mailbox design that featured an outer door and an inner safety door. When the outer door was open, the safety door remained closed, so the mail was safe from thieves and inclement weather. When the outer door closed, the safety door would open so that the deposited mail would join the other letters in the box. This safety device was the precursor for the public mailboxes that we see today. And thank you, Mr. Philip P. Downing, for helping us with that situation. And one more. I have Jan Matzeliger, was born in 1852 in Suriname. When he was 21, he traveled to the United States, though he spoke no English. He got a job as an apprentice in a shoe factory in Massachusetts. At the time, the shoe industry was held captive by skilled craftsmen known as hand lasters. The hand lasters had the hardest and most technical job on the shoe assembly line. They had to fit shoe leather around a mole of a customer's foot and attach it to the sole of the shoe. A good hand laster could complete about 50 pairs of shoes a day. And because the work was so, hand lasters were paid very large salaries, which made shoes very expensive to produce. Matzeliger got tired of waiting for the lasters to do their jobs because they worked so slowly. There were huge backups on the assembly line. He went to night school to learn English so that he could read books about science and manufacturing. He had no money, so he constructed models from spare parts and scraps. After years of study, he produced a shoe lasting machine which produce between 150 to 700 pairs of shoes a day, to the hand lasters, 50. Matzeliger died at a young age of influenza, but he left a legacy of more affordable shoes for the general public. Okay.
What did he die from?
The flu.
Oh, okay.
Imagine landing a plane without the help of air traffic controllers. These controllers advise pilots on how to navigate takeoffs and landings without colliding with other planes. Granville T. Woods invented the device that allowed train dispatchers to do the same thing in 1887. Woods' invention is called the multiplex telegraph, and it allowed dispatchers and engineers at various stations to communicate with moving trains via telegraph. Conductors could also communicate with their counterparts on other trains. Prior to 1887, train collisions were a huge problem, but Woods' device helped make train travel much safer. Woods also received a patent for a steam boiler furnace for trains, as well as for an apparatus that combined the powers of the telephone and the telegraph. And we have one about the chef. No chef likes to hear that his or her work has been rejected. But George Crumb was able to make magic out of one man's discontent. In 1853, Crumb was working as a chef at a resort in Saratoga Springs, New York. A customer sent his dish of French fries back to the kitchen, claiming that they were too thick, too mushy, and not salty enough. Crumb, in an irritated fit, cut the potatoes as thinly as possible, fried them until they were burnt crisp, and threw a generous handful of salt on top. He sent the plate out to the customer, hoping to teach the patron a thing or two about complaining. However, the customer loved the crisp chips, and soon the dish was one of the most popular things on the menu. In 1860, when Crumb opened up his own restaurant, every table received a bowl of Crumb. Never patented his invention, nor was he the one who bagged them and began selling them in grocery stores. But junk food lovers the world over still have him to thank for this crunchy treat. Okay. All right. Potato chips. And the last one I had was in 1885. Sarah Good became the first black woman to receive a U.S. patent. Good was born into slavery in 1850. Oh, I told you with that one. And after the Civil War, she moved to Chicago and opened a furniture store. It was there she came up with an idea that would bring more urban residents with limited space into her store. She invented a folding cabinet bed. By day, the piece of furniture could be used by as a desk, but at night, it could be folded out into a bed. Good received her patent 30 years before the Murphy bed, which is a hideaway bed that folds into a wall, was created. Those are some, and I say some, of the inventions that we have, as African Americans have developed. I thank you all, everyone that called in, that had a comment, a question, or just contributed to the conversation. I really appreciate you, and I thank you for listening to the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White show. And I want to leave you with these words. Promise me you'll always remember you're braver than you believe, and stronger than you seem, and smarter than you think. And that's what Christopher Robin told Pooh Bear. And this is what I'm saying to you, my listeners. I appreciate you for calling and listening in. I appreciate those of you that participated in the conversation. I appreciate those of you that called in and listened and you didn't ask a question or make a comment. I appreciate you as well. And I thank you all for spending your time this Friday evening with me. And I'm saying good night. This is Jenny White signing off.